All these years she had saved up her teaching money, kept it in a chiffarobe with a key, which the children knew not to touch. It would be their future. The last time she opened the chiffarobe, it was to send Leland to Morehouse. It was expensive, and he had not fared well. Professor Foster blamed the school. But anyone who knew Leland knew the trouble was with Leland, whom the women called Wu, and who was brilliant, beloved, and weak to life's temptations. They had wasted their precious, second-class colored teacher's wages on Leland at Morehouse. Now Audie was trying to send Pershing there, and Pershing wanted to go. "No, you don't go to Morehouse," Professor Foster said. "You'll go to Morehouse," his mother said. So it was settled. He would go to Morehouse, but the family had to save up the extra money it would take. Pershing would have to spend 2 years at the lesser-known alma mater of his parents, Leland College, before living out his mother's dream. The summer after his freshman year at Leland, he needed a job. He heard the furniture store downtown needed janitors. He dressed and went down and got in line with all the other colored boys wanting to work. The white foreman called him to the front when it was his turn for an interview. "Boy, do you go to school?" the foreman asked. "Yes, sir, I do," he said. "I've just completed my first year at Leland College." "Boy, if you go to college, you don't need a job as a janitor." Few people, white or black, in Ouachita County had the chance to go to college. Resentments ran deep, especially when it came to a colored boy getting to go, when some Southerners were still debating whether colored people were worth educating at all. Too many educated colored people, and it would upset the whole balance of power in the caste system and give other colored people ideas. The man turned to some other boys in line who weren't in school and didn't need tuition and hired them. Pershing had a long memory, and he would nurse that wound for years. Here he was trying to make something of himself, and the invisible hand was punishing the ambitious and rewarding the servile to keep colored people in their place. Later in the summer, he went looking for work at the sawmill. He saw a classmate there from high school and was told the work wasn't too hard. It was stacking wood staves to make barrels. Pershing asked the foreman for a job. There was nothing available, he was told. He was getting desperate. He spotted his friend stacking staves. "Show me how to do this." The friend showed him what to do, and Pershing worked beside him. He looked up and saw the foreman watching him. Pershing pretended not to see him, worked even harder. The foreman left, and when he came back, Pershing was still at work. At the end of the day, the foreman hired him. Pershing finished out the summer stacking staves, not minding the hard work and not finding it demeaning. "Sometimes," he said, "you have to stoop to conquer." Morehouse was a heavenly place. Colored boys racing straight-backed and self-important in their sweater vests, hair brushed back with a hint of a center part. Arriving at chapel to sit with their respective fraternities and daring not take the wrong row. There was a sister school, Spelman, the women sealed off in their cloistered dormitories and emerging in fitted dresses and gloves to be paired with Morehouse men, who were the only men worthy of them. There was the graduate school, Atlanta University, where the brightest of both schools were expected to go to take their masters and doctorates. It was all too perfect for words. Whatever future there was for colored America, they believed themselves to be it, and they carried themselves accordingly. Then there was Atlanta. Too many colored doctors and lawyers and businessmen to count, living in brick houses set back from the road and with staircases inside, driving fancy cars and not apologizing for it. "I saw blacks living like people ought to live," Pershing would say years later. Atlanta was big enough to get lost in. Enough colored people to be anonymous, The colored people drew a fence around themselves and manufactured a world so grand, they told themselves they didn't want whatever Jim Crow was keeping from them. Pershing was at peace. It was the fall of 1937. After the first homecoming game, Pershing and a science classmate by the name of Morris Williams took two girls out dancing. They both chipped in the money they needed and bought slow gin for the four of them and whiled away the night. They took the girls home and were walking back to the dormitory. As they crossed the intersection of Fair and Ashby, Pershing slowed down to a stop in the middle of the street. He was wobbling from the gin. He stood and looked around. He was in Atlanta, in the middle of the night, far from the stooping and yes-ums of Monroe. He was surrounded by a whole campus of somebodies like him, and doing whatever he pleased. He stood in the street, half drunk and half dreaming. Cars slowed and honked, and he paid them no mind. "Boy, come on," his friend said. "Get out the street. That car's gonna hit you, you drunk fool." "Yes, I'm drunk," Pershing said. "I ain't in Monroe. Don't nobody know me, and I don't give a damn." "I'm free," he said. Pershing did not know precisely where he would end up or how, but he knew at that moment that he would never live in another country Jim Crow town again. He would do whatever it took to get as far away as he could. "That bug got in me," Pershing would later say. I wanted to get out." Shadows still hung over him. His big brother Leland was rarely in class, but was a four-letter man at Morehouse and a star pitcher on the baseball team. The Spelman women called out his name on the yard. And then there was Madison, his oldest brother. Madison still hung over him from afar. Madison was a doctor. Madison sang. Madison dressed. The women loved Madison. "So you hit school," Pershing would remember years later. "And that's Foster's brother. That's Foster's brother. It's hard to be the little one. You fighting for identity, and everybody discussing everything you did. And when it was bad, they blew it up." Pershing threw himself into the one thing that brought him the most attention. He had a voice as rich as an organ, so he joined the school choir. He started singing solo at the Christmas concert at Sisters Chapel at Spelman and made a name for himself. In time, people didn't ask about Leland and baseball as much anymore, or about his brother, the doctor. In his senior year, sometime in 1939, Pershing arrived for choir practice one day when the head of the music department, a man by the name of Harold Stotford, called him over. They stood in the rehearsal room as students gathered to practice. "Foster, wait here a minute," Professor Stotford said. "I want you to meet this young lady." A young woman of modest dress and perfect manners stepped forward. She was a gifted pianist and a newer member of the choir. She was the color of the buttermilk he used to make with his mother and had brown hair brushing her shoulder. She looked out from wire-rimmed glasses that were an accurate barometer of how studious she was. Pershing recognized her instantly. She could have been a celebrity on campus had she not had the breeding and sweet nature not to make a fuss of her position. She was the beloved only daughter of the president of Atlanta University, the campus's graduate school, and was well known to anyone with the least awareness of social standing. Her name was Alice Clement. She was a sophomore at Spelman. Her family lived in a mansion high on a hill on university grounds. It was red brick with black shutters. The estate was called Hickory Hill and looked like Mount Vernon. Her father, President Rufus Clement, had a car and driver. Her cotillions and bridge parties were chronicled in the society pages of the Atlanta Daily World, the colored newspaper in town. She was bookish and would not likely have been made Miss Spellman had she even cared to run. But she would know how to throw a dinner party for 12. She was the embodiment of most everything an ambitious colored man of the day was trained to want. "This is the daughter of President Clement," Professor Stotford said. "Who happens to be that gentleman there? President of Atlanta University. I want you to meet Alice Clement."
"How do you do?" Pershing said. He made a mental note to himself to make the most of his good fortune.
At the next choir rehearsal, he made it his business to start a conversation with her in the hope that something might come of it. She finally asked him to take her to a party. He was all too happy to oblige. He put on his wittiest, most charming self, and soon the boy from Monroe, Louisiana, was courting the quiet and self-contained daughter of a university president. Pershing escorted her to parties, took her to dances with a foursome. He was spending more time up at Hickory Hill and gaining automatic admission to the world of the most influential colored people in all of Atlanta. Pershing Foster was not what Rufus Early Clement would have had in mind for his only daughter. Clement had risen from a bellhop and delivery boy in Kentucky to become the head of one of the most elite colored universities in the country and its longest-serving president. He was a square-jawed, politically astute academic who rarely smiled and wore a look of professorial detachment at both the lectern and the many social engagements that demanded his attendance. He met regularly with the likes of Eleanor Roosevelt and Paul Robeson in his capacity not only as a university president, but as a leading figure among the colored bourgeoisie in the South. Clement gained a reputation as a cautious and incurious steward, whom history will record as the man who ousted W.E.B. Du Bois, the leading black intellectual of his time, from a professorship at Atlanta University after years of clashing egos and temperaments. W.E.B. Du Bois arrived at Atlanta University already in his 70s and with plans for an ambitious study on race relations, at around the same time that Clement was confronted with this new boy interested in his only daughter. Clement would be at odds with Du Bois almost from the start, perhaps threatened by the long shadow of his celebrity, or put off by the elder man's impertinent disregard for Clement, who was 30 years younger than Du Bois. But it was just as likely a contest between the accommodating pragmatism of the southern-born Clement and the impatient radicalism of the northern-bred Du Bois. The two men were the very embodiment of the North-South divide among black intellectuals. In any case, Clement blocked Du Bois's every move, even standing in the way of a $1,000 grant Du Bois was pursuing, according to Du Bois's biographer, David Levering Lewis. Du Bois suspected Clement of sabotaging him, and said he regretted the necessity of having to work with a president who seemed incapable of appreciating the great opportunity facing the university. For his part, Clement complained that Du Bois had become extremely difficult, and that he believed Du Bois's age was impairing him. In 1943, Clement found a way to get rid of Du Bois altogether by invoking, with the support of the board of trustees he had lobbied, an arbitrary loophole requiring compulsory retirement at 65. He informed Du Bois that he would be retired when his contract ended at the close of the school year. "The result of this action was disastrous," Du Bois wrote in his autobiography. "Not only was a great plan of scientific work killed at birth, but my own life was thrown into confusion." Du Bois fought back in despair against his termination, Lewis wrote. Students from Morehouse, Spellman, Clark, and Atlanta University rose up in support of Du Bois in a scornful letter to President Clement. "Our regret," they wrote, "is that we did not have more courses under him, and the students who follow us will not have the opportunity which we had in absorbing his rich experience and inspiration."
Du Bois was beside himself. There was no earthly reason why this wish of mine should not have been granted and applauded, he said. His northern friends thought they knew what the trouble was. He's buried himself in the south too long, Arthur Spingarn, the NAACP president, concluded. Protecting ideas nobody but he understands, and raising hope for change, which may be comprehended in 100 years. Du Bois returned north to New York, where he took a position as director of special research at the NAACP, the organization he had co-founded 34 years before, and moved into an apartment on Sugar Hill in Harlem. For his part, Rufus Clement had proven that even if out of his own insecurities and desire for control, he could be a cunning and formidable adversary. He had prevailed in the short run, regardless of the consequences or of which side of history he would ultimately fall on. As for this new young man at his doorstep wanting to court his only daughter, Clement was still sizing him up. Pershing was respectful and well-mannered, as Dr. Clement would have expected of any Morehouse man. He was a math major, smart, clearly. But on the face of it, Pershing was just another student who had worked waiting tables at the cafeteria, and who was just now making a name for himself as a soloist in the choir. He had come from some country town out in Louisiana. Someone said his parents taught school or something. Dr. Clement had never heard of the Fosters, nor had he any reason to recognize Monroe. No young man with the courage to come courting his daughter would have had an easy time of it. Worse still, this was not looking like a move up in Dr. Clement's estimation, so he looked judgingly through his spectacles. But Pershing told of the great plans he had for himself. He talked about pursuing his doctorate in biology at Atlanta University, or maybe going to a graduate school up north, like the University of Michigan or the University of Chicago. Pershing figured that southern elites always loved those northern status symbols, even if they didn't care to live there themselves. Maybe he would get a scholarship to go. Then he would apply for a fellowship in New York, maybe. His brother was a doctor, internal medicine, and he was considering that too, by the way. Pershing was talking the president's language, the vocabulary of upward mobility. He had potential. He was ambitious, if nothing else. And Alice, quiet, demure Alice, had taken to him. He had a street wit about him that made her laugh. He was the life of the party she never was, and she seemed content to bask in his light. Pershing graduated Morehouse with a major in math and a minor in biology in the spring of 1939 and sang solo at commencement. He took up graduate studies at Atlanta University while Alice completed her time at Spelman. He was moving into a world where great things were expected of him. Dr. Clement looked for him to make good on his promise to become someone worthy of his daughter. Madison wanted his baby brother to follow in his footsteps. His mother, too, wanted a second doctor in the family, and knew her youngest had it in him. So he applied to Meharry Medical College in Nashville and was accepted. His mother sent him the registration fee. "I sat awake all night," he said. "Do I want to go, or don't I want to go?" If he could have done anything in the world at that moment, he would have dropped it all and gone up north to New York or out west to California. He'd always had a thing for California. He would go into show business, maybe, and sing and perform on stage. The audiences would love him, and he would be who and where he was meant to be. But he kept his dreams to himself and did what was expected of him. He sent in the registration fee and would start medical school in the South in the state of Tennessee, a place far from his dreams, in the fall. A Thin Light Far Away. In the winter of 1919, when Ida May was trailing her father out to the field, George and Pershing were learning to crawl, and the first wave of migrants was stirring to life, an astronomer made a startling discovery. The astronomer, named Edwin Hubble, working out of the University of Chicago, looked through one of the most powerful telescopes of his time. What he saw would eventually become the most significant astronomical find of the century, and would come to parallel the awakening of an isolated people in his own country. It would confirm what for generations had been whispered of, but dismissed as impossible. It occurred near the start of a long pilgrimage of Americans seeking to escape their own harsh, known world. Hubble identified a star that was far, far away and was not the same sun that fed life on Earth. It was another sun. And it would prove for the first time in human history that there were galaxies other than our own, that the universe was much bigger than humans had ever imagined, that there were, in fact, other suns. The Awakening. You sleep over a volcano which may erupt at any moment. Laura Arnold, describing the South in a debate on the merits of migration, 2 weeks before she herself left North Carolina for Washington, D.C. I'm in the darkness of the South, and I am trying my best to get out. Oh, please help me to get out of this low-down county. I am counted no more than a dog. Help me, please help me. An unidentified letter writer from Birmingham, Alabama. Chickasaw County, Mississippi. Late September, early October, 1937. Addie B., who lived down the road on the same plantation as Ida May, rose early to feed the turkeys at her cabin across the field. Addie B. always fretted about her turkeys. She looked all over and called out to them. But there was no clucking or nipping or kicking of dust. The yard was barren. The turkeys were gone. Mr. Ed, the boss man over all of them, would be coming for his turkeys soon to sell in time for Thanksgiving. There would be no explaining the disappearance to Mr. Ed. The economics were simple. The turkeys were money when money was the one thing nobody had. The punishment? She did not want to think about the punishment. Besides, she had an idea of what happened to her inventory. She decided to tell Mr. Ed her suspicions before he could ask. Mr. Ed rounded up some men. Later that night, around 9 or 10 o'clock, the pounding started on Ida May's door. It was like the sound of wild dogs trailing raw meat. It seemed far away at first, and then it drew closer, mad fists beating the bare face of the cabin. The cabin was dark, and Ida May was asleep. She was alone in the house with little Velma and James and her sister-in-law, Indiana, who was meek and of little help. Her husband was not yet back from his errands in town. She threw back the coverlet and fingered the sides of the walls to get to the front door. She stumbled past the two little ones, who were by some miracle still asleep, stepped around the hearth and between the two beds on each side of the door. Indiana, in the bed closest to the ruckus, got up to follow her and stood behind her and watched. Ida May cracked open the door and saw the men, 4 or 5 of them with chains and shotguns. She recognized the boss man, Mr. Ed, and she recognized his friend, Mr. Willie Jim, another planter, but could not make out the faces of the others standing before her in the middle of the night. She tried to dispense with them, told them her husband wasn't in, and she didn't know when he would be back. That wasn't why they were there. Willie Jim stepped forward to speak for them all. They wanted to know if Joe Lee was in her house. Joe Lee was her husband's cousin, who lived further down the road, and would have had no business there that time of night, which is what she told them. He worked the land like the rest of them, and though well into his 20s, still lived on his father's farm. He had a reputation for taking things that weren't his. She said she hadn't seen him.
Joe Lee is in there, and we want him out of there.
What'd he do?
That's all right. We want him out of there.
They had searched the other sharecropper cabins. Somebody said they saw Joe Lee escape to her house. Willie Jim was getting agitated, thought she was ornery, disputing them like she was, and raised up his chain and drew it back to hurl at her. Mr. Ed stepped forward and told him not to. He liked George and Ida May, and he needed that cotton out of the field.
"Don't you hit her,"
Mr. Ed said.
"That's all right."
"Let him hit me," Ida said, stiffening herself.
"No, he ain't gonna hit you now," he told her.
Willie Jim stepped back, reminded of what they had come for. The men fanned out, their heavy boots clomping the old wood boards on the porch. They surrounded the house and ran toward the back door of the kitchen, the cabin's only other way out, and caught Joe Lee trying to get away. He had fled into the house as Ida May slept. He had darted past Indiana as she lay in bed in the front room. But Indiana was too afraid to tell anybody.
"Why ain't you tell me you saw Joe Lee come through here?"
Ida May asked her afterward. Then she thought about it and realized that if they had caught her in a lie, it would have been worse. And so the two of them concluded it was best that Indiana knew but didn't tell, and that Ida May didn't know and didn't lie. Ida May couldn't go back to sleep, and she couldn't wait for her husband to get back home. Finally, she heard a motor rumbling outside. She ran out to get him.
"Get out! I got something to tell you."
"What is it?"
"They come and got Joe Lee out the house."
"Who?"
"Your boss." "I know Mr. Ed ain't did that. They caught him trying to step out the back door."
They stood, absorbing what it meant, and not knowing why it happened.
"What way they went with him?" George asked.
A part of him wanted to go and set things straight, try to talk some sense into his boss man. Ida May didn't want him to go. No good could come of it. She didn't see which way they went anyway, black as it was, and they had been gone a good while.
Eustis, Florida, December 1941. George Swanson Starling. On the other side of the earth, at a harbor in Hawaii, a bomb exploded. It was at a naval base, Pearl Harbor. People heard it on the radio, not knowing what it meant. The United States was joining the war over in Europe. George Starling got notice to report for an army physical. But the doctor looked him over and disqualified him on account of what the doctor said was a weak heart. George was scared he would die at any minute, but the minutes turned into weeks and then months, and he figured either the doctor didn't know what he was talking about, or his heart had recovered. In the spring, there would be no work after the fruit was picked from the trees. George was hearing talk of war jobs up in a place called Detroit. The factories that made cars were rolling out planes and weapons 24 hours a day. He did not particularly want to go to Detroit. He didn't have people there, nor did he know much about it. But they were paying a ridiculous sum of money, dollars an hour, instead of pennies a box. He could make enough in a couple of months to last him a year. He heard they were so desperate, you could get a job right off the bus. He floated the idea to his wife. Inez didn't want him to go. For most of their marriage, they had been living with Big George at his house on Bates Avenue. She spent her days sweeping up after the White family she had inherited from her mother and aunt and from her grandmother before them. She was scrubbing toilets when what she really wanted to do, she told George, was to go to beauty school in Tampa, the Angelo Beauty College it was called, and learn how to fix hair. She hardly ever saw George as it was,
When he wasn't out picking fruit, he was out in the backwoods selling insurance. Lately, he had taken to ferrying people around in his old car as if he were a cab driver. There were no taxis for colored people, so he took people to town for groceries or picked them up after the show to make a little extra money. Friday nights, all day Saturday and into Sunday evening, George was gone, carrying other people to the things he and Inez could be doing together. He called himself Saving for the Future. He had it all planned out. He would save enough money to put her through beauty school. Then she would start working and help him finish college in Tallahassee. That would be their freedom. So he gave his weekends to his passengers. Sometimes they just showed up at his house for him to take them somewhere. Inez was stirring the grits for breakfast when little George came into the kitchen one morning.
"Well, I'm gonna run this guy downtown to do his shopping," George said. "I'll be back by the time you get breakfast ready."
He took the man downtown and dropped him off with his groceries. On his way home, somebody else flagged him down.
"Hey, little George, what you doing?"
"I'm not doing anything.
How about running me downtown?"
He would start his morning with the best of intentions and not get back until dark.
"But all the while I'm away from home. I'm working," George said.
He knew he would be in for a fight as soon as he stepped in the door.
"My wife would be swole up big as this room by then, 'cause I'm gone all day."
George figured as much and tried to soften her up.
"I know you thought I wasn't never coming back," he said.
She grunted, fuming still. He told her what had happened, and how people had flagged him down in the street and had no way to get their groceries, and how one thing had led to another, and you know there was no way to reach you because there weren't any phones to call from, and anyway, look at what I got. 50 cents on this trip, $1 on that one, and at the end of the day, George pulled in $5, $10, $20, sometimes $30 in change.
"See how much money I made while I was out? I made all of this."
He dumped it all on the bed, quarters, halves, and paper money. Inez was too mad to look at it.
"Well, all of this goes toward your going to school. That's what I'm scuffling for, so you can go to school."
She kept quiet, so he went on.
"I'ma let you save it now," he said, "'cause you know I was sincere. You put it in the trunk, so you know where it is. So when you get enough to go, you can go."
But she wouldn't get over all those lost weekends so easily. If he took her wants for granted, she would do the same for his. She stood there as if she hadn't heard him. So George went and put the money away himself. Soon he had mason jars full of quarters and halves, fruit jars filled with nickels, and change rattling in tin cans. The start of a future, in bottles all over the house. It was the start of 1943. When the picking season was over, and it was nearing spring, everybody's money went dry. The people needing rides trailed off. George saw it coming and started talking again about going to Detroit for the summer to make enough for them to go to school. He made a note to himself. 1943 was the year for Inez to go to beauty school.
"When it gets a little bit warmer, when the fruit season is over," he told her, "I'm going to Detroit to work. Then I could send you to school. It's nothing to do around here during the summer, ain't no working. I can't even make no money hustling. So I'm going out to Detroit and work and send you to school."
George had it all worked out. Inez just listened. The neighbors had been telling her to watch after her husband. He wasn't going to Detroit to work, they said. He was going to be with some woman, probably one of those school teachers he went to school with up in Tallahassee. "Heard one of them was up in D.C. Bet he's going up there to be with her. He's not going to Detroit." Inez was quiet, so he repeated himself.
"This year, you going to Tampa. I want you to go to school. I don't want to go to no school. I changed my mind. I want to go to Detroit with you.
What you talking about? You've been preaching about Angelo Beauty School. Now you want to go to Detroit? You go on to beauty school where you wanted to go. You can always see the world. You can't always go to school. You're not going to Detroit with me. That's it.
The neighbors would surely talk now. Some came up to George himself.
Why you not letting your wife go with you? They say you not going to Detroit, you going to D.C.
He paid them no mind and caught a bus up to Detroit with his friends Sam Gaskin and Charlie Baller, whom they called Mud. The day he left, Inez was too mad and too hurt to say goodbye. She headed to work.
I hope you all take care of yourselves,
was all she could manage.
They made B-29 cargo planes at a plant in Hamtramck. George arrived in the late spring of 1943, and they put him to work on a jig making frame covers for the hatch doors and rudders of the cargo planes. They applied chemicals to the covers to make them strong but light. The chemicals were so flammable that anyone caught with a cigarette in his pocket was fired on the spot. George set about learning the job and adjusting to a gray concrete city he wasn't particular about when a cousin of his wife's showed up unannounced. That was the point. Inez had sent him to see if George was really there and not with some other woman. The cousin reported back that George was doing what he said he was, and only then could Inez feel halfway good about going on to Tampa to take a short course in beauty culture. George worked nights drilling holes around hatch door frames to attach the covers with screws. He had to bend or lie flat or get on his knees and twist himself to drill the holes straight. The place was swimming with communist sympathizers and alleged saboteurs, or so people said in the hothouse of wartime. Because spies were believed to be inside the plants themselves, any missing or wrongly placed screws were enough to draw suspicion and reprisals in an already cheerless endeavor.
This made it a nervous, nerve-wracking situation, George would say years later. You know, you drill in all kinds of ways, and you trying at your very best, and every now and then you're going to get a hole angle. It's not going to be right. But if you got too many of them, then you were in trouble.
And every minute, George was scared the whole place would blow up from all the chemicals and paranoia. Then on the humid night of Sunday, June 20th, 1943, a fight broke out between several hundred white and colored men on Belle Isle, a park extending into the Detroit River on the east side of town. The fighting spread north, south, and west as rumors circulated among blacks that white men had killed a colored woman and thrown her baby into the Detroit River, and among whites that colored men had raped and killed a white woman in the park. Neither rumor turned out to be true, but it was all that was needed to set off one of the worst riots ever seen in the United States, an outbreak that would mark a turning point in American race relations. Until the 1943 uprising in Detroit, most riots in the United States, from the 1863 draft riots in New York to the riots in Tulsa in 1921, to Atlanta in 1906, to Washington, D.C., to Chicago, Springfield, and East St. Louis, Illinois, and Wilmington, North Carolina, among others, had been white attacks on colored people, often resulting in the burning of entire colored sections or towns. This was the first major riot in which blacks fought back as earnestly as the whites, and in which black residents, having become established in the city but still relegated to run-down ghettos, began attacking and looting perceived symbols of exploitation, the stores and laundries run by whites, and other outsiders that blacks felt were cheating them. It was only after Detroit that riots became known as primarily urban phenomena, ultimately centered on inner-city blacks venting their frustrations on the ghettos that confined them. The Detroit riots went on for close to a week, ending in 34 deaths and more than 1,000 wounded. The Sunday night the riots began, as many as 5,000 people joined in the stoning, stabbing, beating, and shooting. So many people injured that the municipal hospital was admitting riot victims at a rate of one a minute. George was living at 208 Josephine near Hastings and Woodward and heard the mayhem in the streets and on the radio all through the night. He was living in the middle of the crowded colored quarter, mockingly called Paradise Valley, where blacks were stoning the cars of passing whites. Whites were beating up blacks as they emerged from the all-night theaters on Woodward, and an inspector on the scene reported to the police commissioner that the situation was out of control. The rioting continued into the next morning. It was now Monday, the start of the work week. A co-worker of George's called him up.
"Hey, Starling, what you gonna do?"
"Do about what?"
"About going to work."
"I'm going."
"Man, you must be crazy."
"What you talking about?"
"Don't you know?
Where you been?
You didn't know it was a riot going on?"
"Yeah, but I ain't got nothing to do with it. I ain't in no gang."
"This ain't no gang fight. This is a riot."
"Well, they ain't gonna bother me. I ain't done nothing to nobody. I'm going on to work."
"You're gonna get yourself killed."
George had to take two trolleys to get to Hamtramck. He boarded the first in a colored neighborhood and instantly knew something was wrong. The colored people were sitting up straight. The white people were crouched in their seats so they couldn't be seen out the window.
"Wonder why these people down on the floor like they are," he asked himself.
The trolley made its way to a white neighborhood, and now the colored people crouched down, and the white people sat up.
"Well, what in the devil is going on?" he said to himself.
The trolley pulled into the intersection. A mob, two blocks long, stood cursing outside the trolley.
"What's wrong with all them people?" he thought.
The mob became a single organism, descending on the trolley. The trolley operator moved fast.
"He went back the other way," George said. "That's the only thing that saved us. And that's when I began to realize the seriousness of this thing."
He managed to make it to work that day, but the trouble wasn't over. The rioting continued all day Monday and into a second night. When he got back home to Hastings Street that evening, a mob was approaching from Woodward, howling and turning over cars.
"I ran so fast till my heels were hitting my back," he said.
And as he rounded the corner onto Josephine, he could see a colored mob forming.
"They were turning over white cars," he said, "dumping the people out like you dump ashes out an ashtray and setting the cars on fire."
Some colored men in his block stood on the sidewalk, trying to figure out what to do. They had gathered the empty bottles in their flats to throw at people if it came to that.
"We were wondering how it was going to end up," George said.
A white undertaker in the block joined the colored men, contemplating the situation. He did not leave when the other white people fled. He fixed his feet on the ground with his neighbors who happened to be colored, and let it be known where he stood. He might need their protection if it came to that.
"You know, them white folks raising hell over there on Woodward Avenue,"
the white undertaker started to say.
"Yeah, they sure are," George said.
The white undertaker drew closer and into their circle.
"But us colored folks is giving 'em hell over own Hastings," he said.
The colored men welcomed a new brother, and they all laughed at the meaning of that. George stood on the porch and watched the National Guard tanks with machine guns on top parade through the streets. He sat up all night looking out the window as they passed. He heard windows smashing, and then saw a man with a sofa on his back. Another one had a shoulder of meat, A third had about 5 or 6 loaves of bread in his arm. One morning, as the riots wore on, he passed a Florsheim shoe store while heading to work. People were grabbing shoes through the broken glass and running in the morning sun. A co-worker was with him and ran over to the store. "Come on, let's get some," he said. "Man, I don't want no shoes," George said. "I don't need no shoes like that." The friend went in without him, grabbed 2 shoes, and went tearing down the street. He was giddy until he looked at what he had. He had made off with 2 left shoes. "Now he gonna go back and try to find the mates," George said. George told him he was crazy. "No, man, these good shoes," his friend said. "If I find the mate to these shoes, I don't have to buy no more shoes for a good while." He went back in the store, and in that instant, the police showed up and caught him in the act. They fired shots, and one hit him in the stomach. He later landed in jail. The looters took over after the mob cleared out. Within days, the freight trucks rolled up to Hastings and Josephine and all over Detroit and came to a stop in front of suspect stoops. Out came men in overalls pushing dollies, coming for the stolen merchandise. Minutes later, George saw a sofa come out of a 2-flat. Somebody had seen the tenants looting and told. When the time came to go back to work, George rounded the corner to get to the entrance and felt sick. "I got the feeling like I was walking into Alcatraz or Sing Sing," he said, "to begin a lifetime sentence." At the plant, he learned that several men he worked with had gotten shot in the rioting. 1 or 2 had been killed. Between the riot and the anti-communist paranoia and the plant itself, it was time to go. "Look, I can't take it," George told his foreman. "I can't come in here another day." "Well, you know you are frozen on this job." "But I'm defrosting. I cannot come in here no more. Now, you can take it any way you want. I'm just not coming back. You know, if you walk out of here, you subject to be in the army in the next 24 hours. "I can't help that," George said, knowing he'd already been rejected for army duty. "I'm gone." "You have to wait till the pay period to get your money." "I want my money now. I'm gonna sit right here. I ain't going nowhere until y'all give me all of my money. Now, y'all can do what you want. I'm leaving." Finally, they cut him a check. And I left the next day. It was late summer now, and going into autumn. There were only 2 places he knew of to go and live. One was New York, where he had aunts and uncles and no job. The other was Florida, where he had a wife, a father, the dim hope of going back to school, and a patched-together work life of whatever came up. He caught a bus home to Florida with a sense of dread and defeat. He had gone to college and gone up north, and now was returning to exactly the same place he had left. He went back to picking fruit. But instead of hundreds of men in their prime standing at the corner of Bates and Palmetto, hoping to board the truck, a small cluster gathered there. Old men and women, errand boys and domestics, children too, who would never have made the cut before the war, along with a few young men like Charlie Mudballer and Sam Gaskin and George, who hadn't been chosen to go off to fight. With the high rollers gone, the 3 of them reveled in their good fortune. Here they were, the only strong pickers left, the trees heavy with fruit, the fruit rationed and prized like never before. The packing houses, helpless to get the fruit out of the trees, and not knowing how long the situation, meaning the war, would drag on, forced to pay an extra nickel a box to entice anybody who could crawl to get on the truck to come pick. George, Mud, and Sam boarded the truck with the newcomers and rode out 30-40 miles into the grove. Only it was different this time. George was seeing the world in a new light after being in Detroit. The three of them had gotten used to fair wages for their hard work up north, and walked with their backs straight now. George, in particular, never had the constitution to act subservient, and his time up north, where colored people didn't have to step off the sidewalk, only made him more impatient with the role the southern caste system assigned him. He had gotten used to carrying himself in a different way, talking to white people as equals in Detroit. Now that he was back in Eustis, he made a point to do whatever he could to keep from addressing white people as sir or ma'am. They'd say, "So-and-so and so, boy," he said. I would never say yes, sir, or no, sir. I'd say, "That's right. Sure. Certainly." "What you mean by certainly?" would come the indignant reply. "You don't know how to say yes, sir." A colored teacher who had finished the University of Michigan ran into the same trouble in Mississippi at around the same time. He needed to send a wire to a colleague and went into a drugstore to do so. The drugstore owner asked where the wire was going. "Do they have a phone there?" the druggist asked. "Yes, they do," the colored teacher replied. "Do they have a phone there?" the druggist asked again. "Yes, they have a phone," the colored teacher said, wondering why the druggist hadn't understood him the first time. "God damn it, when you talk to a white man, you say, sir." The teacher, to avoid further escalation, addressed him as sir and walked out the door. There he saw a group of white men waiting. The teacher jumped into his car. "I didn't run," the teacher said, "but I made haste to my car and left that town just as fast as I could." George knew that the minutest breach of protocol could be risky, but had a hard time submitting to it. The North had changed, him and Mud and Sam, too, and they couldn't go back to the way they were before. The three of them had a plan. They were tired of having to take whatever pennies the packing houses decided to pay them, and with the war on and not enough pickers, this was one of the few times the workers had any leverage. George, Mud, and Sam decided to make the most of the situation and stand up for themselves like men. They took to strolling the grove and assessing it themselves before setting their ladders in a tree. Sam and Mud walked the grove as if they were the foreman and looked over the density of the fruit to see what they were in for. George stayed with the crew of old men and women, warming themselves by a fire in the fog. The workers wanted to know when they could start picking. George stood with them and told them the plan. "Now look," he said. "Everybody sit down till we get the price straight. Nobody go to work."
"What about the foreman?"
"I don't care what the foreman say. Nobody go to work until we give the word." The old men and women were used to cleaning white yards and cooking in white kitchens 10 or 12 hours a day for 75 cents, maybe a dollar. George told them if they could get a good price, they could make that much in an hour or two. Sounded like voodoo talk to them. "We got to take what the white folks tells us," they told him. "You can't do no different." George looked back down the row for Mud and Sam to show up, and back at his skeptical army.
"I don't want to hear that stuff," George said. "I've been listening to that all my life."
The old men and women worried what would happen if they didn't get their price, and worried all the more if they got it. With the war on, it was a new day, George told them.
"We got a chance to kind of get back at them," he said, trying to inspire them to stand up for themselves. "I ain't thinking about no future. I'm thinking about right now."
Besides, Sam and Mud had already tried to scare the pickers into submission.
"Anybody put a ladder up under them trees," Mud told them, "we gonna snatch it from under you and stomp you when you hit the ground."
The pickers waited. Mud and Sam emerged from deep in the grove.
Well, what it looks like, George asked.
It's pretty good over here in one spot, they said.
Well, what do you think?
We'll do it for 22 cents.
George spoke for the group, since he was the one who had been to school. He went to the foreman to start the unthinkable act of negotiating with a white man.
What you paying for this? George asked the foreman.
Well, you know, this is good fruit, boy, the foreman said. Now you can get well in here. These oranges big as grapefruit.
How much you paying?
We paying good. That's 15 cents a box.
That ain't good enough.
Nope, we can't pick it for that.
We want 22 cents a box.
No, we can't give you that.
George thought it over.
Okay, we'll do it for 22 cents. Straight through, good and the bad.
No, we can't.
Well, we can't pick it then.
We 40 miles from town.
I know. We still not gonna pick it.
Well, y'all pick a load. I don't want to send the truck driver back empty. So y'all pick enough so he can take a load into the packing house. Then I send word to the boss and tell him what y'all wanting to do.
No, we not going to pick one. You can send the truck back to town and we'll wait.
Got nothing to do.
Y'all just doing us this way because y'all got the advantage over us. This war ain't gonna last forever, and by God, y'all gonna pay for this.
We already paid, George said. All these years, we couldn't even ask how much you were paying for a box of fruit, or we'd get fired.
You gave us what you wanted to give us. You promised us one thing and give us another. You put the payday off whenever you get ready. Sometimes you didn't pay us, period. So now, far as I'm concerned, this is reckoning day, and I ain't worried about after the war. You can pay us what we want, or else your fruit gonna hang out there. And they want it in New York. They want it all over the world. And you ain't got nobody to pick it.
The foreman kneaded the fruit out of the trees. He left with the truck driver, and before long was back from the packing house. He told them to go to work. He would pay them 22 cents. This time. The old men and women set their ladders in the trees and commenced picking. And by nightfall, they and these cocksure boys had made more in a day than they would have otherwise made in a week. People could buy stew meat now and put Sunday suits on will call at Ferran's. The mason jars of quarters little George was saving up multiplied. He knew the wages they were making out in the groves couldn't last forever. Everything depended on the supply and demand created by the war, and who knew how much more time they had. He decided to make the most of it while he could. The way things were going, he could earn enough money for college and then some. Until then, while the money was flowing, he thought it was time to rent a place of their own and get out from under his father. Maybe that was what he and Inez needed, now that she was back from her short course in beauty culture.
Go downtown and look in Thompson's, he told her. Pick out some things you think you would like to have for the house, so we know what we're doing when we move.
I don't want to go down there and ain't got no money, she said.
George always had these grand ideas, planning their future in his head.
How you gonna buy any furniture? She asked. You ain't got no money to buy no furniture with.
Don't worry about it. Just go and look. You never can tell what might take place.
One day he just took her by the hand.
Come on, he said. I'm gonna take you down to Thompson's, and you gonna pick out some furniture.
Pick it out? What you gonna pay for it with?
Get your coat and come on, let's go.
George scooped up 7 or 8 jars of quarters and halves, and they went to Thompson's.
What you see in here that you like? He asked her.
She saw a bed, a sofa, a dining room set. How much is that? George asked the clerk, a white man.
You could pay $2 down and 75 cents a week on it, the clerk said.
I don't want to know all of that. I want to know how